From PRI, Public Radio International.
He pushed down the hood on his padded coat. His head was curious, flat as a cardboard cutout, with hair stuck to his sweaty forehead in black curlicues. And his face was as doggedly determined as two fists raised. They began talking in whatever language it was they spoke. Layla's tone pleading, the boys aggrieved. Layla took the money from her pocket and held it up to him. She slapped his hand away when he tried to wrest all the coins from her palm. And then, as abruptly as he had appeared, he left.
You're listening to Eve Best, reading from Loose Change by Andrea Levy, which we'll hear later on this edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Three contemporary female authors, three splendid actresses, and three rather different stories, each about women on the move in one way or another. That's what this edition of Selected Shorts has to offer. The first two stories we'll hear were read at our evening entitled Passport to London, and were written by two women who represent different strands in the multiracial, multiethnic fabric of that great metropolis. We'll begin with She Shall Not Be Moved by Shireen Pandit, who was a lawyer and political activist in South Africa before she was exiled in 1987 and moved to London. Her story, She Shall Not Be Moved, is read for us by Rita Wolfe, a busy New York actress who began her career at London's Royal Court Theatre.
I swear, if it hadn't been so late, I'd have done something about it. Or if the previous two number 201 buses hadn't vanished into thin air. Or if it hadn't been so cold. Or if I didn't have Marion with me, almost turning blue with the cold. Yes, I would definitely have done something about it. There and then. I would have given him a piece of my mind. And them. But the thing is, it was late. And the buses hadn't come for more than an hour. And this being London, it was pretty darn cold, and there was Mariam shivering next to me. So I was highly pleased, I tell you, when that bus finally pulled up. I paid. Well, that's another thing. It was the last change I had on me, and I couldn't afford to get chucked off, could I? Anyhow, this bus finally comes. I put Mariam up alongside me while I pay. Then I try to move her along into the bus ahead of me. Only we can't move. The aisle's blocked by this huge woman with a pram in the middle of the aisle. But she seems to be Somali, from her clothes. Long, dark dress, hair covered with a veil, like nuns used to wear, arms covered to the wrists, nothing but face and hands showing. The driver shouts at me to move down the bus, only I can't because of this pram. I'm about to say to him, "Well, get this woman to move out of the way." It's one of those modern buses with a special place for prams, when I see what the problem is. There are these two women sitting in those fold-up seats in the pram space. White, 50-ish, wrinkles full of powder and grey roots under the blonde rinse. Mouths like dried-up prunes, both of them. One of them's wearing a buttoned-up cardi like Pauline in EastEnders. The other one's wearing a colourless, crumpled and none too clean mac of some kind. The big-breasted, big-bottom type. Both look strong enough in the arm to lift a good few down the pub every night. They're sitting right under that notice which says, "Please allow wheelchair users and those with prams priority in using this space." Which means these two are supposed to get up so the Somali woman can put her pram in the space left when their seats fold up. Only they're staring hard out the window, pretending they haven't heard a word of what's going on, and if they did, it's nothing to do with them. As I said, they didn't look like the kind to tackle unless you wanted a real scene. I wouldn't have put it past the likes of them to use some pretty rough language, regardless of whether there were kids around. Me? Nah, I don't like exposing Mariam to unpleasantness. So I turned to the driver, who's still yelling down the aisle from behind his glassed-in box. I reckon it's his job to tell the women to move. I mean, why should I do his dirty work? There are two empty seats right opposite the women. They can just move over the aisle. I look hard at them, trying to will them to look around. They finally can't resist looking round to see the havoc they've caused. They're still trying to be nonchalant, but you can see this gleam of satisfaction in their eyes, their mouths growing ever thinner as they jam their lips grimly together as if to say, "That'll show you who's boss." I take the chance to point the empty seats out to them, politely. I'm doing as my mum said when I was young, always show them we're better. So even though I've got a small kid with me, I'm not scrambling to grab the seat. Usually I let Mariam sit down because buses jerking around can be dangerous for kids, especially kids like Mariam, small for her age and skinny to boot. But do these old so-and-sos take the seats I'm pointing out to them? Not likely. They look at me, they look at the seats, as if they're a pile of dog dirt I'm offering. Then they mutter something to each other, turn up their noses and stare out the window again like it's nothing to do with them. The Somali woman, meanwhile, has squashed herself tight up against the side of the aisle just below the stairs. If anyone really wants to, they can squeeze past and go on upstairs. Her face is tight too, lips set, eyes blank, head held high. She looks like a haughty queen. She's done her best to accommodate other passengers by leaving them what inches she can, and now she just shuts off and looks into space. Through all this, the driver's been yelling on and off. Finally, his door swings open, the glassed-in bit, leading into the bus, I mean. Right, I think. Here he comes. He's going to make the old witches move. He's not scared of a big strapping bloke. He doesn't have to be scared of anyone or anything. Besides, he's got right on his side. They can't even complain among themselves, let alone to his employers that he's taking sides with the Somali woman just because they're both black. Oh, but oh no, he comes at this Somali woman and yells at her that either she folds up the pram or she leaves the bus. He's all over her, leaning right into her face and shouting. I reckon he's going to hit her. I hate violence, and I turn Mariam's face away. I don't like her seeing ugliness like this. The Somali woman doesn't give an inch, except to turn aside disdainfully because this bloke's spit is flying in her face, pulling her wrapper more closely about her. She says scornfully, she's not doing either. And you can see why not. Her baby's asleep in the pram. She's got another one hanging on to her. One hand on the pram, another on the toddler. Her face is full of contempt for this driver, but her voice isn't rude or loud or anything. Just firm. She's paid. She's got these kids. She's staying put. He shouts and storms. Eventually he gives up and goes back and starts the bus so it jerks. And she and the kid and the pram nearly go flying, except for the pram being stuck. Me? I'm totally shocked at his attitude. I'm really building up a head of steam here. If it wasn't for all the stuff I said before, at this stage, I really would have given him a go. But he's gone back and there's nothing I can do about him. I tell the Somali woman to sit down in the empty seat, thinking she can at least hold the small one on her lap, and maybe I could steady the pram while Miriam sits next to her. She shakes her head wordlessly. It's like she's used up all her words on the driver. I reckon maybe in spite of her looking so proud and firm, she's too timid to give the women a go. Maybe she's worried, being black and a foreigner, probably a refugee and all. Maybe she doesn't like a scene and is already embarrassed enough by the women. Maybe if she'd said something to them directly, I would have backed her. But how could I go and attack them out of the blue, make them move if she's not saying anything to them? The two women, deciding that they aren't having enough fun, start a loud conversation with each other about how they're not getting up no way. Cardi reckons to Mac that they, meaning women with prams, or does she mean black women, just pretend they want to park the pram and then snatch the seats. They want everything their way. Well, definitely black people this time. And on they go. I'm fuming, among other things, because Mariam being subjected to all this racist hogwash. What's the point in having a go, eh? It'll only lead to a row lasting the whole bus ride, and I probably will get chucked off them for stirring, even if I'm in the right. They can say what they like about anti-racist laws, but I've yet to see them stop people like these two slinging their poison around. I look at the other passengers in the second half of the bus, past the stairs. All white, no one's saying nothing, no one's seeing anything, no one's hearing anything. Not their business. Miriam starts to nudge me and whispers to me to tell the driver to tell the old witches to move. She doesn't call them that, though. Calls them those two ladies. Ladies, my backside. Miriam's language is polite, but this is a kid with attitude. Got it from me, I guess. I used to be known as a kid with attitude. They can have our seats, she says loudly. I nod, but say nothing. Miriam decides to go on, so I feel like really nudging her hard, only I don't hold with hurting kids. They're the problem, she says even more loudly. I look at them again, still saying nothing. I'm thinking that with the Somali woman saying nothing to them and the driver on their side, I'm going to end up outside in the cold with Miriam minus the fare if I take them on. Well, this is what I'm thinking, but not saying to Miriam. Kids, there are things they just don't understand. I mean, Miriam would definitely not get to her dance lesson on time, and then she'd be right miffed. And then there's the bus fare and the fees and the time and everything all wasted. Miriam glares at the women. She glares at me. I know what she's thinking. How many times have I told her to stand up against wrongdoing? How many times have I pushed her into standing up against bullies at school, whether they're bullying her or someone else? Now her only such a small kid for her age. We try to bring her up thinking about right and wrong. Like how many times have I told her that I'm only living in this miserable country because I got into trouble back home fighting for our rights. There are political posters and slogans all over the house. One of them's got Pastor Neumeller's speech, first they came for the Jews and all that. She knows, all right. She knows that I should be speaking up for this Somali woman. And here I am, saying nothing. Doing nothing. Every once in a while, when people get on and mutter something about the aisle being blocked, the driver shouts at the Somali woman. She stands there like a rock. Cardi and Mac have restarted their loud conversation about them wanting to take everything over. I laugh in their faces and start agreeing loudly with Miriam, but I don't say anything to them. The bus is filling up. At a couple of stops, some pretty yobbo-looking types get on. You know, tattoos, earrings all over their faces, hair sticking up. The type that I can't afford to get tangled with. I don't fancy a boot in my face or in Mariam's, while those two probably watch and cheer. The yobbos just squeeze past the Somali woman. It's a couple of blokes in collars and ties who swear at her before they force a path upstairs, nearly making her let go of the pram and fall. You can't always tell by appearances, can you? Then the bus empties a bit. Another middle-aged woman gets on, about the same age as the other two, but this one's sort of frailer-looking. Now, my mum, when we were kids, she'd only have given us what for if we didn't get up and offer our seats to older people. I've got the habit drilled into me. I don't like Miriam getting up, like I said, in case she falls, so usually I give up my seat. But this time, I sit tight. Miriam gives me a questioning look, then makes to get up for this new lady, but I pull her down. Call me a reverse racist, if you like. But if those white women won't get up for the Somali woman, then I'm not giving my seat or my kids to one of their kind. No way, I didn't start this. Now they start a loud conversation about their manners, meaning me. I glare at them and say nothing. I can feel Miriam wriggling with impatience for me to mouth off at them. But I reckon with the driver on their side, even against this poor woman with her pram and her kids, what chance have I got? He'd probably call the police for me if I gave him lip. And guess whose side the police would be on? So I glare and sit tight. I stare straight ahead, like this old lady standing is nothing to do with me. I can feel my lips tighten with satisfaction at getting back at the other two. See how they feel when it's one of their kind getting a dose of it. But I'm feeling right small inside. I feel like a real sod. Not only for not standing up for the Somali woman, but for not giving my seat to the old white woman. Plus, Miriam starts hassling me about getting up for the old woman. I almost blow my top at Miriam. I mean, can't she see what I'm doing? Standing up to them. I pull her down again and glare at her, whispering, "No!" fiercely at her as she struggles to stand up and give her seat to the old woman standing. Then I feel like a right idiot. getting upset at Mariam. The kid's only doing what she's been taught. I make my excuses to Mariam, but she's not taking any notice of me. She doesn't exactly look like she wants to cry, like when she's mad at me, though. Her face is just the same as usual, not swelling up and going red like it always does before she starts to cry. But her eyes have that sad, lost, grief-stricken look. I sit there, feeling right helpless. I'm trying to remember where I know that look from. The bus has come into a main shopping area. People are walking around with holly-printed plastic bags full of goodies. And that makes me remember when Mariam had that look on her face. She had it when she woke up in the night last Christmas and found her dad stuffing her stocking. I feel sick at the thought of what she's thinking of me. The thing is, what can I do? You can teach kids to stand up against bullies, but sometimes they've got to learn that discretion is the better part of valour. I start to explain, but Mariam isn't taking any notice. She looks again at the old woman swaying about on the bus, trying to hold on to prevent herself falling. Then she gives me a look, like I've just chucked away her favourite teddy bear. At last, we get to Wood Green, and the troublemakers get off, slinging her last few barbs over their shoulders. At that, the Somali woman finally snaps. She lets go of the pram and leans out the doorway and shouts, "Racists!" after them. They're still hurling abuse at her, as if they were the injured parties, as they disappear into the crowd, everybody staring. But thank God, it's Wood Green, and the sea of faces staring interestedly at us is as much black as white. The Somali woman starts to struggle to turn the pram so she can get off too. I offer to help her, muttering to her that she should report the driver. "What's the good of that?" she says bitterly. "But why do you think he's taking their part?" I ask her. "Because I am truly confused. I mean, he's a black man." The black woman is clearly in the right, so as I said before, he can't get into trouble with the company if he tells the white woman to get up or get off. The Somali woman gives me a long look. "Because he is a slave," she says. "He is a slave," she repeats loudly through the still open back door of the bus, at the driver collecting fares from passengers boarding at the front. I realise from her attitude that they probably already played it all out, she and the women and the driver, before I even got on the bus. "But me," she says, looking at me hard again, "I am not a slave. I would rather die than be one." Her voice is like granite, hard and immovable. Every word falls heavy as a stone between us, cuts into me like a diamond. I feel my face turn red as I take Mariam's hand. All through Mariam's class, that woman's words go round and round in my head. I reckon it's me she's called a slave too for not sticking up for her. And the thing is, I'm not even mad at her, if that's what she is saying. I'm just upset at myself for not doing anything. And then, there's Mariam. People reckon kids forget things quickly, but I know Mariam. All afternoon, I sit there, watching her. I want to tell her she still shouldn't let people walk all over her just because they're white or stronger or richer or anything. I don't want her not to stick up for other people if she sees wrong being done to them. But I also want to tell her that you can't always do that. You've got to pick your moments. Then I ask myself, what's the good of raking it all up again? What's done is done. After her class, Mariam asks to go to the bagel shop for a hot buttered bagel. This is our usual routine, or our little treat. I suggest an extra special treat instead. I take Mariam for a pizza and let her have Coke as extra, extra special. She looks puzzled for a moment at all this, but then she's yakking away, back to her usual bouncy self. I reckon there's nothing like a special treat to let kids forget bad memories. Soon she's blowing bubbles into her Coke through her straw. She's got a smear of pizza tomato on her cheek. So why can't I forget the whole thing? Is it because I imagine a bit of Mariam's look of this afternoon still about her every time she looks at me?
She Shall Not Be Moved by Shireen Pandit, read by Rita Wolf. Our second London-based story is called Loose Change and was written by Andrea Levy, a Londoner whose four novels explore the issues faced by black Jamaican immigrants living in that city. The reader making her Selected Shorts debut is Eve Best, who starred in the revival of Harold Pinter's The Homecoming, both in London and on Broadway. She's a native of Ladbroke Grove, near the Notting Hill neighborhood of London, and she trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. She co-stars on the TV series Nurse Jackie. Here is Eve Best to read Andrea Levy's Loose Change.
I'm not in the habit of making friends of strangers. I'm a Londoner. Not even little grey-haired old ladies passing comment on the weather can shame a response from me. I'm a Londoner. Aloof sweats from my pores. But I was in a bit of a predicament. My period was 2 days early and I was caught unprepared. I'd just gone into the National Portrait Gallery to get out of the cold. It had begun to feel, as I'd walked through the bleak streets, like acid was being thrown at my exposed skin. My fingers were numb. Searching in my purse for change for the tampon machine, I barely felt the pull of the zip. But I didn't have any coins. I was forced to ask in a loud voice in this small lavatory, "Has anyone got 3 20-pence pieces?" Everyone seemed to leave the place at once. All of them Londoners, I was sure of it. Only she was left, fixing her hair in the mirror. "Do you have change?" She turned round slowly as I held out a £10 note. She had the most spectacular eyebrows. I could see the lines of black hair, like magnetized iron filings, tumbling across her eyes and almost joining above her nose. I must have been staring to recall them so clearly. She had wide black eyes and a round face with such a solid jawline that she looked to have taken a gentle whack from Tom and Jerry's cartoon frying pan. She dug into the pocket of her jacket and pulled out a bulging handful of money. It was coppers, mostly. Some of it tinkled onto the floor. But she had change. Too much. I didn't want a bag full of the stuff myself. "Have you a £5 note as well?" I asked. She dropped the coins onto the basin area, spreading them out into the soapy bubbles of water that were lying there. Then she said, "You look..." She had an accent, but I couldn't tell then where it was from. I thought maybe Spain. "Is this all you've got?" I asked. She nodded. "Well, look, let me just take this now." I picked up 3 damp coins out of the pile. "And then I'll get some change in the shop and pay them back to you." Her gaze was as keen as a cat with string. "Do you understand? Only I don't want all these coins." "Yes," she said softly. I was grateful. I took the money. But when I emerged from the cubicle, the girl and her handful of change were gone. I found her again staring at the portrait of Darcy Bustle. Her head was inclining from one side to the other as if the painting were a dress she might soon try on for size. I approached her about the money, but she just said, "This is good picture." Was it my explanation left dangling, or the fact that she liked the dreadful painting that caused my mouth to gape? "Really? You like it?" I said. "She doesn't look real. She looks like..." Her eyelids fluttered sleepily as she searched for the right word. "A dream." That particular picture always reminded me of the doodles girls drew in their rough books at school. "You don't like?" she asked. I shrugged. "You show me one you like," she said. As I mentioned before, I'm not in the habit of making friends of strangers. But there was something about this girl. Her eyes were encircled with dark shadows so that even when she smiled, introducing herself cheerfully as Layla, they remained as mournful as a glum kid at a party. I took this fraternization as defeat, but I had to introduce her to a better portrait. Alan Bennett, with his mysterious little brown bag, didn't impress her at all. She preferred the photograph of Beckham. Germaine Greer made her top lip curl. And as for A.S. Byatt, she laughed out loud. This is child, make this! We were almost making a scene. Layla couldn't keep her voice down and people were beginning to watch us. I wanted to be released from my obligation. Look, let me buy us both a cup of tea, I said. Then I can give you back your money. She brought out her handful of change again as we sat down at a table, eagerly passing it across to me to take some for the tea. No, I'll get this, I said. Her money jangled like a win on a slot machine as she tipped it back into her pocket. When I got back with the tea, I pushed over the 20 pences I owed her. She began playing with them on the tabletop, pushing one around the other two in a figure of eight. Suddenly, she leant towards me, as if there was a conspiracy between us, and said, I like art. With that announcement, a light briefly came on in those dull eyes to reveal that she was no more than 18. A student, perhaps. Where are you from? I asked. Uzbekistan, she said. Was that the Balkans? I wasn't sure. Where is that? She licked her finger, then with great concentration drew an outline on the tabletop. This is Uzbekistan, she said. She licked her finger again to carefully plop a wet dot onto the map, saying, And I come from here, Tashkent. And where is all this? I said, indicating the area around the little map with its slowly evaporating borders and town. She screwed up her face as if to say, Nowhere. Are you on holiday? I asked. She nodded. How long are you here for? Leaning her elbows on the table, she took a sip of her tea. Ech, it's bitter, she said. Well, put some sugar in it, I said, pushing the sugar sachets towards her. She was reluctant. Is for free? She asked. Yes, take one. The sugar spilled as she clumsily opened the packet. I laughed it off, but she, with the focus of a prayer, put her cup up to the edge of the table and swept the sugar into it with the side of her hand. The rest of the detritus that was on the tabletop fell into the tea as well. Some crumbs, a tiny scrap of paper, and a curly black hair floated on the surface of her drink. I felt sick as she put the cup back to her mouth. Pour that one away, I'll get you another one. Just as I said that, a young boy arrived at our table and stood, legs astride, before her. He pushed down the hood on his padded coat. His head was curious, flat as a cardboard cutout, with hair stuck to his sweaty forehead in black curlicues. And his face was as doggedly determined as two fists raised. They began talking in whatever language it was they spoke. Layla's tone pleading, the boys aggrieved. Layla took the money from her pocket and held it up to him. She slapped his hand away when he tried to wrest all the coins from her palm. And then, as abruptly as he had appeared, he left. Layla called something after him. Everyone turned to stare at her, except the boy, who just carried on. Who was that? With the teacup resting on her lip, she said, My brother. He wants to know where we sleep tonight. Oh, yes? Where's that? I was rummaging through the contents of my bag for a tissue, so it was casually asked. It's square, where we have slept before. Oh, which hotel is it? I thought of the Russell Hotel that was on a square with uniformed attendants, bed-turning-down facilities, old-world style. She was picking the curly black hair off her tongue when she said, No hotel. Just the square. It was then I began to notice things I had not seen before. dirt under each of her chipped fingernails. The collar of her blouse, crumpled and unironed. A tiny cut on her cheek, a fringe that looked to have been cut with blunt nail clippers. I found a tissue and used it to wipe my sweating palms. How do you mean, just in the square? We sleep out in the square, she said. It was so simple, she spread her hands as if to suggest the lie of her bed. Outside? She nodded. Tonight? Yes. The memory of the bitter cold still tingled at my fingertips as I said, Why? It took her no more than two breaths to tell me the story. She and her brother had had to leave their country, Uzbekistan, when their parents, who were journalists, were arrested. It was arranged very quickly. Friends of their parents acquired passports for them and put them onto a plane. They had been in England for 3 days, but they knew no one here. This country was just a safe place. Now all the money they had could be lifted in the palm of a hand to a stranger in a toilet. So they were sleeping rough in the shelter of a square, covered in blankets, on top of some cardboard. At the next table, a woman was complaining loudly that there was too much froth on her coffee. Her companion was relating the miserable tale of her daughter's attempt to get into publishing. What did they think about the strange girl sitting opposite me? Nothing. Only I knew what a menacing place Layla's world had become. She'd lost a tooth. I noticed the ugly gap when she smiled at me, saying, I love London. She had sought me out, sifted me from the crowd. This young woman was desperate for help. She'd even, cunningly, made me obliged to her. I have a picture of Tower Bridge at home on wall, although I have not seen yet. But why me? I had my son to think of. Why pick on a single mother with a young son? We haven't got the time. Those two women at the next table with their matching handbags and shoes, they did nothing but lunch. Why hadn't she approached them instead? From little girl, I always want to see it, she went on. I didn't know anything about people in her situation. Didn't they have to go somewhere? Croydon, was it? Couldn't she have gone to the police or some charity? My life was hard enough without this stranger tramping through it. She smelt of mildewed washing. Imagine her dragging that awful stink into my kitchen, cupping her filthy hands round my bone china, smearing my white linen, her big face with its pantomime eyebrows leering over my son, slumping onto my sofa and kicking off her muddy boots as she yanked me down into her particular hell. How would I ever get rid of her? Do you know where is Tower Bridge? Perhaps there was something tender-hearted in my face. When my grandma first came to England from the Caribbean, she lived through days as lonely and cold as an open grave. The story she told all her grandchildren was about the stranger who woke her while she was sleeping in a doorway and offered her a warm bed for the night. It was this act of benevolence that kept my grandmother alive. She was convinced of it. Her Good Samaritan. Is something wrong? The girl asked. Now my grandmother talks with passion about scrounging refugees, those asylum seekers who can't even speak the language, storming the country and making it difficult for everyone else. Last week, she began, her voice quivering, I was in home. This was embarrassing. I couldn't turn the other way. The girl was staring straight at me. This day, Friday, she went on, I cooked fish for my mother and brother. The whites of her eyes were becoming soft and pink. She was going to cry. This day, Friday, I am here in London, she said. And I worry I will not see my mother again. Only a savage would turn away when it was merely kindness that was needed. I resolved to help her. I had 3 warm bedrooms, one of them empty. I would make her dinner. Fried chicken or maybe poached fish in wine. I would run her a bath filled with bubbles. Wrap her in thick towels heated on a rail. I would then hunt down some warm clothes. And after I had put my son to bed, I would make her cocoa. We would sit and talk. I would let her tell me all that she had been through, wipe her tears, and assure her that she was now safe. I would phone a colleague from school and ask him for advice. Then in the morning, I would take Layla to wherever she needed to go. And before we said goodbye, I would press my phone number into her hand. All Layla's grandchildren would know my name. Her nose was running with snot. She pulled down the sleeve of her jacket to drag it across her face and said, "I must find my brother." I didn't have any more tissues. "I'll get you something to wipe your nose," I said. I got up from the table. She watched me, frowning, the tiny hairs of her eyebrows locking together like Velcro. I walked to the counter where serviettes were lying in a neat pile. I picked up 4. Then, standing straight, I walked on. Not back to Layla, but up the stairs to the exit. I pushed through the revolving doors and threw myself into the cold.
Loose Change by Andrea Levy, read by Eve Best. We'll be back after a short break with a great story called Pie Dance. You're listening to selected shorts recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. Our third and final story is a very funny one by an American woman, Molly Giles, who teaches at the Creative Writing Department at San Francisco State University, and it has the intriguing title, Pie Dance. A man, his current wife, his ex-wife, and the dog are the principal characters in this little domestic comedy. Our reader is the award-winning actress, Kate Burton.
I don't know what to do about my husband's new wife. She won't come in. She sits on the front porch and smokes. She won't knock or ring the bell. And the only way I know she's there at all is because the dog points in the living room. The minute I see Stray standing with one paw up and his tail straight out, I say, "Shh, it's Pauline." I stroke his coarse fur and lean on the broom and we wait. We hear the creak of a board, the click of a purse, a cigarette being lit, a sad, tiny cough. At last I give up and open the door. "Pauline?" The afternoon light hurts my eyes. "Would you like to come in?" "No," says Pauline. Sometimes she sits on the stoop picking at the paint, and sometimes she sits on the edge of an empty planter box. Today she's perched on the railing. She frowns when she sees me and lifts her small chin. She wears the same black velvet jacket she always wears, the same formal silk blouse, the same huge dark glasses. "Just passing by," she exclaims. I nod. Pauline lives 30 miles to the east, in the city, with Conrad. Passing by would take her one toll bridge, one freeway, and two backcountry roads from their flat. But lies are the least of our problems, Pauline's and mine. So I nod again, bunch my bathrobe a little tighter around my waist, try to cover one bare foot with the other, and repeat my invitation. She shakes her head so vigorously the railing lurches. Conrad, she says in her high young voice, expects me. You know how he is. I do, or I did. I'm not sure I know now, but I nod. And she flushes, staring so hard at something right behind me, that I turn to and tell Stray, who is still posing in the doorway, to cancel the act and come out and say hello. Stray drops his front paw and pads forward, nose to the ground. Pauline blows cigarette smoke into the wisteria vine and draws her feet close to the railing. What kind is it? She asks, looking down. I tell her we don't know. We think he's part Irish setter and part golden retriever. What happened was someone drove him out here to the country and abandoned him, and he howled outside our house until one of the children let him come in. Pauline nods as if this were very interesting and says, oh, really? But I stop abruptly. I know I am boring. I am growing dull as Mrs. Dixon, Conrad's mother, who goes on and on about her poodle and who, for a time, actually sent us birthday cards and Christmas presents signed with a poodle paw print. I clasp the broom with both hands and gaze fondly at Stray. I am too young to love a dog. At the same time, I am beginning to realize there isn't that much love in this world. So when Pauline says, can it do tricks? I try to keep the rush of passion from my eyes. I try to keep my voice down. He can dance, I admit. How great, she says, swaying on the railing. Truly great. Yes, I agree. I do not elaborate. I do not tell Pauline that at night when the children are asleep, I often dance with him. Nor do I confess that the two of us, Stray and I, have outgrown the waltz and are deep into reggae. Stray is a gay and affable partner, willing to learn, delighted to lead. I could boast about him forever, but Pauline, I see, already looks tired. And you, I ask, how have you been? For answer, she coughs, flexing her small hands so the big gold wedding ring flashes a lot in the sun. She smiles for the first time and makes a great show of pounding her heart as she coughs. She doesn't look well. She's lost weight since the marriage and seems far too pale. Water, I ask, or how about tea? We have peppermint, jasmine, mocha, and lemon. Oh, no, she cries, choking. We've honey, we've cream. Oh, no, but thank you so much. After a bit, she stops coughing and resumes smoking. And I realize we both are staring at Stray again. People, Pauline says with a sigh, are so cruel. Don't you think? I do, I think, yes. I tell her Stray was half-starved and mangy when we found him. He had been beaten and kicked, but we gave him raw eggs and corn oil for his coat and had his ears sewn up and took him to the vets for all the right shots, and look at him now. We continue to look at him now. Stray, glad to be noticed and flattered, immediately trots to the driveway and pees on the wheel of Pauline's new Mustang. Of course, I complain, he's worse than a child. Pauline bows her head and picks one of Stray's hairs off her black velvet jacket. I guess, she says. She smiles. She really has a very nice smile. It was the first thing I noticed when Conrad introduced us. It's a wide smile, glamorous and trembly like a movie star's. I once dreamt I had to kiss her, and it wasn't bad. I didn't mind. In the dream, Conrad held us by the hair with our faces shoved together. It was claustrophobic, but not at all disgusting. I remember thinking when I awoke, poor Conrad, he doesn't even know how to punish people, and it's a shame because he wants to so much. Later, I noticed that Pauline's lips, when she's not smiling, are exactly like Conrad's, full and loose and purplish. Sad. I wonder if when they kiss, they feel they're making a mirror. I would. Whether the rest of Pauline mirrors Conrad is anyone's guess. I have never seen her eyes, of course, because of the dark glasses. Her hair is blonde and so fine that the tips of her ears peek through. She is scarcely taller than one of the children, and it is difficult to think of her as Conrad's executive assistant. She seems a child dressed up. She favors what the magazines called the layered look. I suspect because she is ashamed of her bottom. She has thin shoulders but a heavy bottom. Well, I want to tell her who is not ashamed of their bottom. If not their bottom, their thighs, or their breasts, or their wobbly female bellies, who among us is perfect, Pauline? Instead of saying a word of this, of course, I sigh and say, some days it seems all I do is sweep up after that dog. Stray, good boy, rolls in dry leaves and vomits some grass. As if more were needed, as if Stray and I together are conducting an illustrated lecture, I swished the broom several times on the painted porch floor. The straw scrapes my toes. What Pauline doesn't know, because I haven't told her and because she won't come inside, is that I keep the broom by the front door for show. I keep it to show the Moonies, Mormons, and Jehovah's Witnesses who stop by the house that I've no time to be saved, can't be converted. I use it to lean on when I'm listening, lean on when I'm not. I use it to convince prowlers of my prowess and neighbors of my virtue. I use it for everything, in fact, but cleaning house. I feel no need to clean house, and certainly not with a broom. The rooms at the back are stacked to the rafters with dead flowers and song sheets, stuffed bears and bird nests, junk mail and seashells, but to Pauline, perhaps, my house is vast, scoured, and full of light. To Pauline, perhaps, my house is in order. But who knows with Pauline? She gives me her beautiful smile, then drops her eyes to my bathrobe hem and gives me her faint, formal frown. She pinches the dog hair between her fingers and tries to wipe it behind a leaf on the yellowing vine. I don't know how you manage, is what she says. She shakes her head. Between the dog, she says, grinding her cigarette out on the railing, and the children. She sits huddled in the wan, freckled sunlight with the dead cigarette curled in the palm of her hand. And after a minute, during which neither of us can think of one more thing to say, she lights up another. It was the children, she says at last. I really wanted to see. They'll be sorry they missed you, I said politely. Yes, Pauline said. I'd hoped. Had you but phoned, I add. Just as politely, dropping my eyes and sweeping my toes. The children are not far away. They said they were going to the end of the lane to pick blackberries for pie, but what they are actually doing is showing their bare bottoms to passing cars and screaming, hooey. Hooey, hooey. I know this because little Dixie Stedman, who used to babysit before she got her master's degree in female processes, saw them and called me. Why are you letting your daughter celebrate their femininity in this burlesque? Dixie asked. Her voice was calm and reasonable, and I wanted to answer, but before I could, there was a brisk, papery rustle, and she began to read rape statistics to me, and I had to hold the phone at arm's length, and finally, I put it to Stray's ear, and even he yawned. Showing all his large yellow teeth, and then I put the receiver down very gently, and we tiptoed away. What I'm wondering now is what hooey means. I'd ask Pauline, who would be only too glad to look it up for me. Her curiosity and industry made her, Conrad said, an invaluable assistant right from the start. But I'm afraid she'd mention it to Conrad, and then he would start threatening to take the children away. He does that, he can't help it. It's like a nervous tic. He loves to go to court. Of course, he's a lawyer, he has to. Even so, I think he overdoes it. I never understood the rush to divorce me and marry Pauline. We were fine as we were, but he says my problem is that I have no morals, and perhaps he's right. Perhaps I don't. Both my divorce and Pauline's wedding were executed in court, and I think both by Judge Benson. The marriage couldn't have been statelier than the dissolution, and if I were Pauline, only 24 and getting married for the very first time, I would have been bitter. I would have insisted on white lace, or beige anyway, and candles and lots of fresh flowers, but Pauline is not one to complain. Perhaps she feels lucky to be married at all. Perhaps she feels lucky to be married to Conrad. Her shoulders always droop a little when she's with him. I've noticed, and she listens to him with her chin tucked in and her wrists poised, as if she were waiting to take dictation. Maybe she adores him. But if she does, she must learn not to take him too seriously or treat him as if he matters. He hates that. He can't deal with that at all. I should tell her this, but there are some things she'll have to find out for herself. All I tell her is that the girls are gone up the lane picking berries. How wonderful, she says, exhaling. Berries. Blackberries, I tell her. They grow wild here. They grow all over. In the city, she says, making an effort, a dinky little carton costs 89 cents. She smiles. Say, you needed 3 cartons to make 1 pie, she asks me. How much would that cost? I blink, one hand on my bathrobe collar. 267. Her smile deepens, dimples. 267 plus tax when you can buy a whole frozen pie for 156, giving you a saving of 111 at least. They don't call them convenience foods, Pauline says, for nothing. Are you sure? I ask after a minute. You don't want some tea? Oh, no. Some coffee? Oh, no. A fast glass of wine? She chuckles, cheerful, but will not answer. I scan the sky. It's close, but cloudless. If there were to be a thunderstorm, and we often have thunderstorms this time of year, Pauline would have to come in. Or would she? I see her erect and dripping, defiant. Mrs. Dixon, I offer, had a wonderful recipe for blackberry. Mrs. Dixon? For a second, I almost see Pauline's eyes. They are small and tired and very angry. Then she tips her head to the sun and the glasses cloud over again. Conrad's mother. Yes, she says. She lights another cigarette, shakes the match out slowly. I know. A wonderful recipe for blackberry cake. She used to say that Conrad never liked pie. I know. Just cake. I know. What I found out, Pauline, is that he likes both. We never eat dessert, Pauline says, her lips small and sad again. It isn't good for us, and we just don't have it. Stray begins to bark and wheel around the garden, and a second later the children appear. Letty first, her blonde hair tangled and brambly like mine. Then Alicia, brown-eyed like Conrad. And then Sophie, who looks like no one unless... Yes, with her small proud head, a bit like Pauline. The children are giggling and they deliberately smash into each other as they zigzag down the driveway. Oops, they cry with elaborate formality. Do forgive me, my mistake. As they come closer, we see that all three are scratched and bloody with berry juice. One holds a mason jar half full and one has a leaky colander, and one boasts a ruined pocket. Pauline closes her eyes tight behind her dark glasses and holds out her arms. The girls giggling jostle toward her. They're wild for Pauline. She tells them stories about kidnappers and lets them use her calculator. With each kiss, the wooden railing rocks and lurches. If these visits keep up, I will have to rebuild the porch. Renew the insurance. I carry the berries into the kitchen, rinse them off, and set them to drain. When I come back outside, Pauline stands alone on the porch. Stains bloom on her blouse and along her out-thrust chin. Come in, I urge, and wash yourself off. She shakes her head very fast and smiles at the floor. No, she says. You see, I have to go. The children are turning handsprings on the lawn, calling, "Watch me, watch me!" As Stray dashes between them, licking their faces. I walk down the driveway to see Pauline off. As I lift my hand to wave, she turns and stares past me toward the house. I turn too, see nothing, no one, only an old wooden homestead covered with yellowing vines, a curtain aflutter in an upstairs window, a red door ajar on a dark brown room. "Thank you," she cries. Then she throws her last cigarette onto the gravel and grinds it out and gets into her car and backs out the driveway and down to the street and away. Once she turns the corner, I drop my hand and bite the knuckles hard. Then I look back at the house. Conrad steps out, a towel gripped to his waist. He is scowling. Angry, I know, because he spent the last half hour hiding in the shower with the cat litter box and the tortoise. He shouts for his shoes. I find them towed out in flight, one in the bedroom, one down the hall. As he hurries to tie them, I tell him a strange thing has happened. It seems I've grown morals. What? Conrad snaps. He combs his hair with his fingers when he can't find my brush. Us, I say. You, me, Pauline. It's a lot of hooey, I tell Conrad. It is. Conrad turns his face this way, that way, scrubs a space clear in the mirror. Do you know what you're saying? He says to the mirror. I think. Yes. I know what I'm saying. I'm saying goodbye. I'm saying, go home. And when he has gone and the girls are asleep and the house is night still, I remember the pie. I roll out the rich dough, flute it, and fill it with berries and sugar, lemons and spice. We'll have it for breakfast, the children and I. We'll share it with Stray. Would you like that? I ask him. Stray thumps his tail, but he's not looking at me. His head is cocked. He's listening to something else. I listen too. A faint beat comes from the radio on the kitchen counter. Even before I turn it up, I can tell it's a reggae beat. Strong and sassy. I'm not sure I can catch it. Not sure I should try. Still, when Stray bows, I curtsy. And when the song starts, we dance.
Kate Burton read Pie Dance by Molly Giles. You can find more stories about passionate women on our selected short CD, Wondrous Women. You can find out all about it by going to selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Kellaway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2009 by Alice Siebold. Support for this program also comes from Bas Bleu, a source of an eclectic mix of books and gifts for readers, online at basbleu.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, Lila Atchison Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.